It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today we present our year in review, a look at many of the top stories of 2018. A series of tragic events have brought the community together this year, but first, a look at a different set of challenges. Earlier in 2018, decisions in state and federal courts led to changes in the congressional district's map, as well as changes to the makeup of the Pennsylvania congressional delegation. In studio with us is WESA Government and Accountability Editor Chris Potter and reporter Anlee Herring. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
All right. So usually the congressional districts, they're redrawn every 10 years with the new census data. These maps had been in place for three elections. Briefly, why challenge in time for 2018? And even more importantly, why were they successful?
Well, I mean, a couple things. The biggest is that the challenge came after the 2015 off-year elections in which three Democrats were elected to the state Supreme Court. That shifted the court's balance into a strongly Democratic, a decidedly Democratic skew. And those justices, as candidates, were asked often at forums and things like that about what they felt about redistricting. So I think the plaintiffs clearly thought they had an advantage, that they were going to get a sympathetic hearing from this court, and as obviously they did. There's also some other developments too. I think on the national level, there are a lot of people sort of rethinking how we draw the lines here. And in Pennsylvania, of course, they did have three election cycles of results. So you could say, like, hey, why is it that a state that's purple and balanced sort of 50-50 has such a partisan skew of Republicans?
So they've got the three Democratic justices on the state Supreme Court. That's what Democrats and those who wanted the maps redrawn were counting on. But the Republicans opted to try to fight this in the U.S. Supreme Court, and that didn't work.
That's true. That didn't work. And with the U.S. Supreme Court, you really see a reluctance to intervene when it comes to redistricting. They say this is a legislative matter, so we're going to honor the separation of powers here. With the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the justices were not so inclined to hold back, and they said, this is clearly a partisan gerrymander, and we think it's our place to step in. And that's kind of the contrast there.
There's also a bit of it, too, which is that a lot of these cases are sort of proceeding under the auspices of the state constitution, citing particular provisions within the state rules. And sometimes the federal system tends to yield to a top state's court's ability to decide its own rules, and that can be a factor as well.
Yeah, that's definitely a factor. But you had Justice Max Baer at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, who I believe is a registered Democrat.
He was
very hesitant to let this go forward and to kind of rush through this new redistricting process in such short order. So there was a voice speaking for keeping this in the legislature.
He wasn't opposed to the redrawing of the maps. He just, as you said, don't rush it through for the 2018 election. That was his main bone of contention?
Yeah, he agreed with the diagnosis. He didn't agree with the proposed cure. That's right. And he was worried about sort of chaos, and a lot of Republicans were worried about that. I think on this side, I don't know that they're, you know, the Commonwealth still stands. So
okay. Briefly, Anlee, you covered this race very closely, the special election in the old House District 18. This was, as I said, this was before the new maps took effect. I'm going to ask you about Connor Lamb and Rick Saccone. It was a very slim victory for Connor. Was it expected to be that close, or was that a bit of a surprise?
As we got closer to the election, you could tell it was a very competitive race, and a lot of that was due to Connor Lamb's strength as a candidate, and he was able to build this coalition of union workers and then a lot of voters in the suburbs who were looking to unseat the Republicans in this district. And Rick Saccone bears responsibility, too. He wasn't a very strong candidate on a lot of scores, and he really ended up depending on national money, and he will blame them for kind of taking over the narrative and not telling the story he wanted to, but it did happen.
Okay. Briefly, I wanted to get to, is there any way to get a sense of whether Connor Lamb's victory in an old 18 helped him in the new district in which he ran against a Republican incumbent, Keith Rothfuss.
Polling data suggests that it really helped him. It built his name recognition. He was an incumbent. That was the only race in the nation to feature two incumbents. So he just came in with a really strong profile. People knew who he was. They knew him as a moderate, and that works well in this region.
Yeah, Ann Lee probably remembers this as I do. In that special election, there were people outside of the 18th district who thought they were going to be voting in it because they'd seen so many TV ads. The other thing I'd just say about that race, too, is that it also reflected that Connor Lamb's original special election win in March, as we sit here today looking back, I think it's fair to say that it really was an omen for what happened in November, which is he was, as Ann Lee rightly points out, he was able to win with the support of a lot of college-educated suburban voters, and they came out for him again in November in his race, but also for Democrats as a whole, and I think that dynamic drove the reason why Democrats were able to take the U.S. House in November.
Okay, so after the 2016 elections, Republicans in the Pennsylvania congressional delegation held a 13-5 edge. Now, 2 years later, well, come January, it'll be 9-9, and four women members of the Pennsylvania congressional delegation. Is it fair to say that's unheard of in this state?
Yes.
I mean, what was it, just great campaigns or people saying, no, I want to change? What's your sense?
I think, all of these women were elected sort of from the eastern part of the state. So it's a little hard for us here, I think, to sort of gauge the success of, you know, were these tactics particularly successful. But I do think, and we saw there was one female candidate out here, Bibi Borio, who was running in much of the old 18th district, but the very kind of Republican parts of it. She obviously struggled for that reason. I think a few things. I think, yeah, people were looking for a change. Women voters especially, and especially women voters in the suburbs, really drove Democratic success. And the party, very wisely in the eastern part of the state, put up exactly the kind of candidate that they could identify with. So I think both things were going on there. They kind of reflected that change. And the fact that they were female candidates absolutely did not hurt.
Okay, lightning round on a couple other election points for you. Elsewhere in the midterms, Casey and Wolf won re-election. No surprise there. Braddock Mayor John Fetterman, Lieutenant Governor. New city councilor elected in District 8, Erica Strasburger, taking over for Dan Gilman, now the mayor's chief of staff. Summer Lee and Sarah Inamorato sailed to victory after the primary. Was the success of DSA candidates an aberration, or are more traditional candidate Democrats going to have to take notice of what happened here?
I think that's the biggest question the Democratic Party may be facing right now, which is how far to that sort of very progressive activist base do we want to go? Mike Doyle always talks about, the congressman from Pittsburgh always talks about, vote your district. There are districts where that DSA message plays well. I have to say that the two victories you talked about, Summer Lee and Sarah Inamorato, and I mean nothing to take away from those candidates, but what they also had going for them is incumbents who I think had gotten out of the habit of really running. Mm-hmm. And it just got their kind of campaign muscles had sort of atrophied. So it's a little difficult to say broadly, because so many of these districts have so many different characteristics. What played well in Lawrenceville wouldn't necessarily play well in Kennedy Township or Kilbuck.
Okay. And very briefly, still waiting for a resolution to Lindsey Williams Senate District 38.
Yeah, we're still waiting to hear what Republicans actually plan to do in regard to that. Lindsey Williams has filed, I think, nearly 100 pages of records showing that she was a resident of Pennsylvania in time to run in this election, according to her. So we'll see if Republicans want to keep up with their challenge.
Okay, so I want to get to the government accountability aspect of your jobs as editor and reporter. In our court system, there seems to be a growing movement to end life without parole in Pennsylvania. Are many inmates in prison without a chance to get out in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, Pennsylvania actually is the state with the second highest number of inmates serving life without parole. So it does stand out on that score, and that's part of the motivation for activists calling to end this policy.
Okay. Now, the A thing that I want to mention for you is also about police residency. City of Pittsburgh Police, only I believe you reported about one out of five were living outside the city now.
Yes, we revisited a Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision that had taken place in May of 2017. In May of this year, just seeing what the fallout from that might have been, and we found that about 20% of officers in the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police now live outside the city because that Supreme Court decision said they were not required any longer to live in the city if they contracted that requirement away.
And final question, any way to assess the repercussions of that? You know, they always talk about police being immersed in the community. And
right. It's tough. And one of the reasons that makes it tough is a lot of the officers who were living outside the city basically were recruited from outside of the city, if I recall correctly. The story was in May, and that's in Donald Trump's America. That seems like 1,000 years ago. The other side of it, too, some people will tell you is, look, to be honest, if we're honest, a lot of the officers, even when they were city residents, were concentrated in a handful of neighborhoods that weren't necessarily anything like the neighborhoods they were policing. So you'd be in a place like Lincoln Place or Brookline or a handful of other kind of communities that weren't necessarily the same demographics and same profiles as like a Homewood or some of the Northside communities.
All right. WESA editor Chris Potter and Ann Lee Herring, reporter in the Government Accountability Team, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Legal sports betting is officially underway in Pennsylvania, and one of the first bets left one man short $10,000. The bet, placed at Rivers Casino, favored the Patriots winning last week's football game, but the Steelers pulled out a 17-10 win. And soon you'll be able to dispose of those crusty paint cans and old electronics in your basement. City Council gave preliminary approval this week to a contract that would offer hazardous waste disposal in the city. If passed, there will be fees based on how much and what type of products you're getting rid of. Find more online at WESA.FM.
It's the Confluence Year in Review Show on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Of course, government leaders are often the driving forces for new developments. So let's bring in WESA's development and transportation reporter, Margaret J. Krause, and Chris Potter remains with us in studio. Margaret, one word, one name dominated the news when it came to possible developments in Pittsburgh area this year, and that word, that name was
Amazon.
Is right. She wins the contest. Now, have we gotten a sense that Pittsburgh was really seriously considered? Yeah, it made the final 20, but...
Well, the argument about millennials could be used for the cities being considered by Amazon. We all win. We're all winners because we're all special snowflakes. Maybe early in the process, it seems documents coming out of the New York Times suggest that perhaps after that short list of 20 that Pittsburgh made last January, that we kind of fell off the running, but they like us, is the takeaway.
All right. So we got a participatory ribbon or something?
Sadly, I don't think there have been any ribbons.
Okay. Now, Peduto, Mayor Peduto admitted there was no communication from Amazon since a less than 24-hour visit in April. In fact, he said, the phone didn't ring, he told me. So really, wasn't that sort of a message, you're out of the running?
I mean, I think it was the love affair that wasn't, but it's a very...
One-way love affair?
Well,
okay.
I don't know. But maybe let's not stick with that metaphor, but Amazon is a gigantic company whose aims are often not clear, and it's possible that if you're a city leader who loves your city, perhaps you thought, you know, like, maybe this is how they're just doing this.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, the county and the Port Authority have reapplied for a federal grant, about $100 million, for bus rapid transit. Briefly, how would it work from where to where? And then I'll ask you, so where do we stand on this grant?
Sure. So there's a main branch that runs from downtown to Oakland and then splits off. There is one that continues on the East Busway out to Swissvale. The other will go through Highland Park. And then that third branch will continue down to the first part of Greenfield.
Okay. So it was a reapplication. I believe it was in this fall.
Yes. It was this September.
Okay. Do they have any sense of when they're going to get a word from the feds about any money?
Well, we're standing on the eve of a government shutdown, there's not a lot of hope for funding in a lot of places. However, last year, the federal government did rate the project very highly. However, new funds weren't being appropriated. So we'll know in the early spring whether or not we get that $100 million. What's most interesting is that local officials have said, we'll find some way to do it.
Okay, in our remaining minute and a half, I want to bring you both into this. Mayor Peduto has been talking about his One Pittsburgh initiative in earnest since April, some might argue for the last 5 years or so. You both got a big story dropping on that this morning. What is One Pittsburgh and what's the holdup?
Oh.
Chris, Margaret.
I think you should start, Margaret. Okay. So One Pittsburgh is both a mindset and a financial vehicle. The idea is let's prioritize all the projects that are going on. Let's get all the stakeholders to all pull in the same direction. And let's find a way, a place to put that money outside of government, a nonprofit, to actually fund those efforts. It was announced in April. There was this big kickoff event. The holdup, it's unclear. Officials have, I will report this morning that the idea is they want to get all those stakeholders to really buy into the vision and make it clear. I asked if financial commitments were a holdup. There remains yet a dollar to go to this fund. And they said, no, it's not about financial commitments. It's about the stakeholders.
The challenge for the city is Mayor Peduto has been talking about getting money from the UPMCs and the Allegheny Health Networks of the city since 2014, since his first year in office. We are now 5 years basically into this administration, and there is yet to be a firm commitment of a single dollar here. You know, the mayor said, I'll be able to do this, get a bigger deal, better deal than Mayor Ravenstahl if we drop this lawsuit challenging UPMC. We have yet to see that happen.
All right. Maybe in 19?
Maybe. Who's to say?
Okay. Chris Potter is government accountability editor. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's development and transportation reporter. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin with your year in review. For a look back at Pittsburgh area professional sports in 2018, we're turning to a familiar voice who, despite living in California, keeps a closer eye on Pittsburgh sports than I do, and that's pretty close. David Green, host of NPR's Morning Edition, probably the network's most avid Pittsburgh sports fan. Hi, David.
How are you? And are you sure I keep tabs on Pittsburgh sports more than you? I think you follow them pretty closely. Kevin.
Well, I do. But, David, I want you to give me one word to sum up the year in Pittsburgh sports. What would that word be for you?
Roller coaster.
Good word.
How about that?
Good word. Does that apply to all the Pittsburgh sports?
I think so. I would, yeah.
So, David, for me, the word would be unfulfilled. I like roller coaster, but unfulfilled because
I like that.
The promise, yeah. So let's go into a little more depth about roller coaster. The Steelers, yeah, they had us going. And, of course, 2018, you've got the end of one season. You've got through the playoffs, and then you've got the whole regular season that we're just nearly completing. That Jacksonville loss that hurts so much in the playoffs.
It really did. But I mean, isn't, and this might be overly optimistic, but doesn't 2018 feel a little bit like 2005?
Ooh.
Like you had this late season plunge, but then you had like one game, that game against the Bears at Soldier Field where Bettis ran through Urlacher into the end zone. And then they didn't stop. They won every game. They won a Super Bowl. I mean, this might be the overly optimistic side of me, but there does, like, the trajectory feels kind of eerily similar.
Boy, you're an optimist.
Yeah, not usually. If you hear me during games, I mean, when my fist is slamming, no one would call me an optimist.
Well, the Penguins, you know, had a chance to do something that I believe only three other NHL teams have done in the history of the Stanley Cup, win three straight cups. Let me put it this way.
Okay.
Do you think the Capitals got more satisfaction of finally beating the Penguins or winning the cup?
I would say it's almost equal. When I was spending time in Washington, the elation I saw over beating the Penguins almost matched the elation that I saw from fans after they took the cup home. So I think it's that bitter a thing. And I certainly, I mean, DC getting that cup, you know, it meant a lot to that city, and we're just going to have to hope that they never do it again.
Okay. So the Pirates had a roller coaster season of their own. Did they have us fooled? They got off to a good start, then they faded. But in spring training, if I had said to you, they're going to win 82 games this season in 2018, what would you have said to me?
I thought they were going to be a 500 team, but then they took us on that, you know, as I said, roller coaster. I mean, I actually thought going into the All-Star break that maybe they would grab a wild card. What, they were only back like 5-6 games at that point? And the way they were playing and the energy, it just felt like something was coalescing. And then, you know, it just didn't work out that way. It was unfulfilling, to use your word.
Yeah, this roller coaster we've been talking about seems to keep going down, a lot of dips rather than rises. Sort of been focusing on the negative, but any positive, any high notes for you during 2018?
That drive, that Tom Brady drive, and that noise level at Heinz Field after everything that Steelers defense had taken us through this year, the bitter disappointments, I mean, the not standing tall in the key moments during the losing streak, all the way back going to the Jacksonville game in January, like to stand tall at that moment and respond to the fans and see Heinz Field whipped up like that and Renegade and everything. Like, I just, you know, I got chills. It just keeps going.
You got chills over the December 16th finally beating New England. All right, David, as we conclude our sports year in review, you can't look back without looking ahead. So I want one sports prediction from you for 2019.
One sports prediction. The Penguins do not make the playoffs.
Ow.
I don't want it to be. I know that they've overcome inconsistency in the past and gone to places we didn't expect in the playoffs in years that didn't look good at this moment, but I'm just not feeling it this year. What about you?
Well, my prediction, or at least hope, is we'll be having the sports conversations in 2019. At least
you make safe predictions. You make safe predictions, Kevin. That is safe. Safer than mine. Good work.
David Green is NPR's most avid Pittsburgh sports fan. David, Merry Christmas to you and your family, and Happy New Year.
Same to you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This year marks some tumultuous moments for Pittsburgh's art world, and WESA's arts and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll was there to cover it all. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Kevin.
So let's start with the Mattress Factory. That storied art museum's founder and director, Barbara Lodorowski, died this year, age 88. But that was just the first blow to this organization. Tell us about the sexual harassment scandal that you uncovered.
Well, this was back in February. Several women employees of the museum came forward internally and said that they had been subject to sexual harassment, sexual assault, even rape by a male coworker at the museum. An internal investigation ensued at the museum, but the alleged perpetrator was never even suspended. And in fact, he left the organization only after employees complained about the way this investigation had turned out there.
Mm-hmm. What's happened since? Changes made?
Well, the museum's co-founder, Michael Olenek, who had co-founded the museum with Lodorowski, was put on temporary paid leave. He still has not returned to active duty at the museum. In September, a number of employees filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board alleging that they had been retaliated against for complaining about the way the museum had responded to these allegations. So that federal investigation is ongoing. Museum has a new interim director, Judith O'Toole, who's trying to sort of set right the museum's reputation in the community.
All right. Pittsburgh filmmakers, they faced a different set of challenges this year. What happened? Where do they stand now?
Well, Pittsburgh filmmakers, Pittsburgh Center for the Arts,
right,
they're part of a merged entity. They announced in the summer that they were getting rid of essentially their film school, which has operated for decades and decades and was at one time the area's leading media arts education organization in terms of film, photography, video, even digital media. They've now sold their building, apparently. They have sold their building, their headquarters in Oakland. They're downsizing to the PCA campus. And so we'll see what happens. They're going to move forward. They're going to try to continue to do some kind of programming, but it's a very small organization than it was before.
Speaking of film, Silk Screen Film Festival is gone for now.
Yeah, this is the Asian American Arts Organization, had its own sexual misconduct scandal. The head of that group was alleged to have done sexual harassment and other kinds of verbal abuse of employees over the years. He retired. He quit the organization back in the fall, and the organization seems to have disbanded for now. They said it, they cited financial problems rather than personnel problems, but it remains to be seen whether they'll reemerge in any fashion or whether that mission to highlight Asian American art and film will reemerge in any fashion.
Less than 2 minutes left. Lighter note, one local theater has hosted shows continuously for more than 80 years. Pittsburgh Playhouse got a bit of an upgrade when it moved from Oakland to downtown, yes?
Yeah, that's a bit of an understatement. They had this kind of ragtag group of buildings that they'd used for 70, 80 years up in Oakland, and now they have this gleaming new facility right downtown, state-of-the-art, multiple theaters, soundstage, all that stuff. They've already started doing programming in there, so that should be a great addition to the downtown art scene.
And what major events stood out to you this year? Of course, the Carnegie International was back. Festival first.
Sure, Carnegie International. This is the Carnegie's 57th, I think it was, long-running series. So they bring in dozens of artists from all over the world this year. Notable because they involved some local artists. Thad Mosley, John Rubin, and Lenka Clayton all had work in the show, which was great. The Pittsburgh Festival first, which was visual art, performance art. Downtown also included some local content, Quantum Theater. Some local artists had work in the show, too.
All right. And Pittsburgh artists getting recognition on a national scale. That's great to see.
Yeah. Most recently, Vanessa German, who's one of Pittsburgh's kind of most admired and best known artists, got recognition for her multidisciplinary work, visual art, performance art, and kind of her activism in the community, her art house in Homewood. And she won the Don Tyson Prize, $200,000 cash prize, just this past week. So a great week for Vanessa, certainly, but also I think for Pittsburgh.
Last 15 seconds, what are you looking forward to in early 19?
Well, you know, Kevin, there's a little show called Hamilton that's coming. You might have heard about it. Of course, that's not a locally produced show. It's a touring version of the big Broadway hit, but people here are obviously very excited about it. It runs, PNC Broadway series is bringing it in. It runs for a whole month, which is pretty unusual for that series. And obviously that's going to dominate the early, you know, the first month of arts news here, probably.
Bill O'Driscoll is the arts and culture reporter at WESA. Bill, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's our year in review program. Reporter and producer Katie Blackley is now in studio, along with Virginia Alvino Young, who covers race and identity here at WESA. Katie, I want to start with you. On a high note, it's been a big year for WESA's Good Questions series. A new book, I've heard, a couple of awards, and how many questions?
You know, we just counted, and we did 38 questions last year under the entire GQ series. So that was pretty exciting. We had a lot of really fun ones. I really liked doing the inclines, where we looked at the historic locations of the about a dozen inclines that used to be in Pittsburgh. We found a Civil War fort in Staten Heights, and it was a lot of fun. And I finally got the book in this week, so I'm holding it right now.
You're holding it right now. And you have a couple on tap that you're working on for 19?
I do, yeah. Do you want me to tell you?
Yeah, just briefly.
Okay, so there are, if you drive on the 10th Street bypass, which is right going along kind of the Allegheny River,
yes,
there are metal rings affixed to the side of the wall.
Okay.
But it's like in the middle of a road, and so it's kind of weird that they're there. So I've been looking into why they're there, when they were put there, and if they've ever been used.
All right, we'll look forward to the answers to those good questions.
Cool.
In addition to Good Question, you also cover news events, including you covered the death of one of Pittsburgh's own, Mac Miller.
Mac Miller, he died in September of this year, and he was a Pittsburgh rapper who signed under the same label as Wiz Khalifa. He died tragically of an overdose. He was 26, and we went to his vigil that night, and it was at Blue Slide Park in Frick Park, which he rapped about a lot.
And yeah, why was that important to him and to his music?
Because he started rapping about his community. And so there was just hundreds of these young kids and young adults who were there celebrating his life and talking about how much his music has impacted them and how it felt like it was the loss of a friend. They found him a very genuine person, someone who was very humble in an industry that's kind of not forgiving. And his death was just very impactful on the community.
And they could identify him within a lot of people because of his age. He was so young.
Mm-hmm. He was only 26.
All right. Pittsburgh has had to deal this year with the shock of violent death more than anyone could have imagined. Virginia, it seems like you've covered almost all of them. Let's start with the shooting death of Antoine Rose Jr. What was your sense of the community's reaction after his death?
I mean, unfortunately, it's becoming this sort of ubiquitous thing that we see happen in communities around the country, right? So it's the hurt, it's the rage and the anger, and rightfully so, with just the loss of a young person, regardless of circumstances, how hard that can be on the community. But it's something that we see, okay, now it's here, now Pittsburgh's on the map for this specific reason, and it's something that I think we're going to see stay with us. It comes to not define, but really inform the future of communities. And so we're already seeing threads of that carry on through community response and policies and community sentiment. So it's something that I think will be with us going forward.
This was a very dedicated group of protesters. This community rallied around Antoine's family and really was trying to promote change. One of the things that will stick with me about this year was the poem that Antoine Rose wrote when he was younger, and it was printed on almost every document that was at these rallies. And it just kind of spoke to, you know, this happened here, and it was very hard for the community to deal with that, rightfully so. And just the words in his poem, even, "I am not who you think," was... Go ahead.
But part of the challenge, too, is it wasn't a cohesive response from the community. I think there was a lot of tension, folks who maybe didn't understand some of the efforts of the protesters, or why were the streets being blocked, or why is this still going on? And so it kind of speaks to some of the disconnect and some of the divide within the relative community experiences in different segments of the city.
Mm-hmm. East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rossfeld will be headed to trial, and the department he worked for will now be serviced by county police. That happened in June, and of course the subsequent protests that you talked about. Then 4 months later, 11 worshipers were murdered in the Tree of Life Synagogue. Was it a different reaction?
Yes, you have to say yes, unequivocally so. What we see is different segments of the community responding to these challenges, and what we saw with Tree of Life and that response was something that was really unprecedented. It brought out this sentiment that we're stronger than hate, that we're all going to unite together against this hatred and against gun violence and against these people who were perceived, again, unequivocally as just innocent, just in their place of worship. And so a tragedy beyond belief, but the response was different because gun violence and the number of deaths that this city sees every year, I mean, mass shootings do not account for the majority of shootings and the majority of lives that are lost in this city. So we see other communities and maybe other people being impacted by gun violence consistently, and the tension there with them not receiving millions of dollars in donations and worldwide attention for their response, right? So that's I think, a tension that is still going to have to be resolved going forward.
These horrific events have been extremely difficult to understand, to deal with. But how are they impacting the children of our community? The Confluence's Megan Harris spoke earlier with WESA's education reporter, Sarah Schneider.
Sarah, how did schools and students respond to incidents like first the Parkland shooting in February and then later here locally, Tree of Life and the death of Antoine Rose Jr.?
So students locally, you know, they really took the lead from the Parkland students who were immediately organizing. So student activism isn't new, but you know, these students locally said time and time again, I heard from them that they did feel empowered now to speak up. So we saw walkouts in a couple schools locally immediately after the Parkland shooting. And then a lot of schools, thousands of students walked out 1 month after the shooting. And then they organized a local March for Our Lives rally that was in March. And many of those students were the same students who walked out and protested when Antoine Rose died and when he was killed by an officer in East Pittsburgh. Students at Woodland Hills organized and rallied and called for stronger gun reform and legislation.
Woodland Hills was where Antoine Rose Jr.
Right,
was a student.
Where he was a student. And then in Squirrel Hill after the Tree of Life shooting, that same night, Saturday night, students organized a vigil for the community. And these were students at Taylor Alderdice High School in Squirrel Hill who had participated in the March for Our Lives rally, and they talked about that night, that, you know, this was something that they didn't want to have to do as students, but that they felt it was important for them to do.
Have school districts, school administrators been supportive of student activism?
Immediately after the Parkland shooting, students at CAPA, which is a downtown performing arts school in the Pittsburgh Public Schools District, walked out and they were disciplined. There were 100 students who were disciplined the day after. After that, students made sure that they were talking to school administrators and they were organizing and making sure that the people knew when they were walking out. So it wasn't technically a walkout because it was organized ahead of time. But the schools were very supportive here in Pittsburgh after that.
CAPA is, of course, a city school district. Was there a divide at all between how maybe suburban districts handled some of the immediate aftermath versus Pittsburgh city schools?
Right. Some of the suburban districts made there were reports that students would be disciplined if they walked out. So a lot of schools opted to stay inside. Some had assemblies where they talked about gun violence. Others, you know, I heard several times that teachers were just talking about it in classrooms.
What did you hear from teachers, from students about some of those conversations? Was it helpful, especially in those immediate days after some of these incidents?
Yeah, I mean, teachers say it's incredibly important to make sure students have a voice after this, to have a space where they can process and ask questions and try to figure out together what's going on, especially the Tree of Life shooting. It's something that a lot of students didn't understand and adults didn't understand either, and it's hard to explain those things. So when I talked to teachers after the Tree of Life specifically, it was, you know, we're just going to try to figure this out together and process.
Did you, in the course of your reporting, come across any interesting approaches that really, you know, maybe touched your heart or stuck to you as they were trying to figure out how to help students grieve and ultimately begin to heal?
I think a lot of students said it was most impactful when they were just given space to, you know, be creative. I spent the day at the community day school in Squirrel Hill after the Tree of Life shooting, and students there, you know, put together a sort of remembrance for the people who died, and they sang songs and prayed together, and that was all organized by them. And you know, we saw the same thing after the Parkland shooting, and when Antoine died, students put together these marches and rallies on their own, and so empowering students and giving them that space seems to be most impactful.
And separately, but certainly hand in hand with all this, Pittsburgh Public Schools specifically embarked on several new and recurring initiatives this year, reducing suspensions, changing their discipline policies. Where do a few of those stand, and what do you expect in 2019?
Well, when it comes to suspensions, there are a couple ways that the district's trying to reduce the overall number. You know, there's this disparity in who is suspended. More African-American boys are likely to be suspended than their peers. And the district has, you know, implemented this approach called restorative practice, and it's more of addressing behavior in the classroom instead of kicking kids out by suspending them. So they're continuing that work, and there are going to be some studies coming out in the next year that I think will be very important in understanding if that's working. Pittsburgh Public specifically is also using this community schools model, which is a wraparound support service model of bringing in community organizers to help students in the building so they don't have to go elsewhere. And so the district is announcing more schools in 2019 will be named community schools. So I'm going to be following that closely.
Sarah Schneider is an education reporter here at WESA. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Megan.
For The Confluence, I'm Megan Harris.
And we continue our year in review with WESA reporters Katie Blackley, Virginia Alvino Young, and joining us in studio, Kathleen Davis. You each covered the aftermath of both the shooting death of Antoine Rose and the mass shooting at Tree of Life. Many officials said the synagogue shooting brought the community together. So did the Antoine Rose killing also bring the community together, maybe in a different way?
That's hard to say because I think you're talking about
I'm talking about a white police officer, black teenager, mm-hmm. and did white and black Pittsburgh come together, I guess what I'm asking.
Sometimes. There were a lot of protests, a lot of gatherings, and there were times when, yeah, at least some of the downtown ones especially, you would see some white Pittsburghers there that were joining in solidarity with the black community here in Pittsburgh. But in places like, I went to a rally in East Pittsburgh right in front of the police department that Michael Rosfeld had worked for, and there were not a lot of white Pittsburghers there.
So for me, something that's even more telling is what happens in the future, what actions are taken and supported by who in the future. So it's one thing to talk about, you know, who showed up to the rally, who was protesting with the picket signs, but really it's Who's going to vote for measures that might change some of the circumstances around some of these tragedies? Some, you know, who's going to actually stand for, you know, justice and equity in the community going forward? So it's really about those actions and who is supporting what. And that, to me, says a lot more about who is coming together.
All right. Another story that really stirred the emotions this year was the release of the grand jury report about clergy abuse. At least 1,000 children over seven decades, six dioceses. To each of you, what did you learn in your immediate reporting from, whether it's parishioners, non-Catholics, church leadership, victims' advocates? What did you learn? Kathleen, let's start with you.
There was such a different response from, I would say, pretty much everyone. It was really interesting to see kind of the layers of how people were responding to this. I personally did a story where I spoke with a Catholic priest in McKees Rocks, and he was very interesting just to speak with because he told me, you know, I 100% believe these allegations. You know, he told me that he had no doubt in his mind that these allegations were true. But I know that one of our other reporters in our newsroom spoke to some people at a service, and some people told her that they thought it was fake news. Mm. So it was such a varied response.
Mm-hmm. What we learned in the immediate aftermath was that it was so much more, so much worse, so much more involved than anybody was really anticipating coming out. And so there was a lot of shock there. The immediate response, some people just stopped going to Mass altogether, couldn't bring themselves to do it. And some people doubled down on their faith and said, this is a more important time than any. But what we're going to need to think about, you know, going forward is how those sentiments evolve, especially as we continue to have this like drip, drip, drip of revelations. Mm-hmm.
Virginia, briefly, how do you expect community policymakers might respond to a very, very difficult challenge long term?
We've seen some efforts, right? And we've seen some efforts fall short. So there have been efforts to reform or change the statute of limitations at the state level for a long time. And you would, you know, if they had a chance, you would think that this would be the year in the wake of this grand jury report. But they did fall short at the state level. So there's going to be efforts continuing on. But I'm anticipating that there will be an effort at change at the local, state, and national level going forward as this continues to unravel.
Right. Okay. We have just about a minute left. To each of you, very briefly, still a lot to cover in the new year. Rosenfeld's trial, Bauer's trial, the alleged shooter in the synagogue killings, the legislative attempts to remove the statute of limitations, as you just mentioned, Virginia. Of course, all these will be on air online at WESA's info, but what will each of you be looking to cover very briefly in regard to these or other stories?
Well, I'm going to be embedding with one of our other reporters on Lee Herring in Homewood for a while. We're going to be spending some time with the community members there and looking at kind of the economic and the community and the future for the kids that live there.
I will be covering as needed. I don't know exactly what I'll be doing. But
when the trials, you're our GA reporter, so as the trials happen, you'll be there.
I would imagine.
All the important everyday stuff.
In about 15, 20 seconds, Virginia.
Yeah, so the future of the Catholic Church right now, I mean, they just had this big reorganization in the Pittsburgh Diocese. We're expecting more compensation funds, more grand jury reports across the country. What's going to happen there? I'm looking very closely at. Also, gun violence, again, it impacts. It's indiscriminate. It impacts many different segments of our community, many different demographics in many different ways. And so there's a lot of stories there that we're not necessarily paying attention to every single day. But what does it all amount to as far as impact on our community? So I'm going to be trying to tease that apart a little more and get some more voices in on that.
All right. Katie Blackley, Virginia Alvino Young, and breaking news reporter Kathleen J. Davis, reporters at WESA. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
And finally, The Confluence became a daily program August 27th, thanks to more than 150 guests who have appeared on our show since then. Thanks to our diligent reporters in the WESA newsroom, and a very special thanks to you for listening. The Confluence is taking a break for the holidays. We will be back January 2nd. What guests would you like to hear on our show in the next year? Email your suggestions to confluence@wesa.fm. And by the way, to catch up on any programs you might have missed, check out wesa.fm. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stinelli. The producer and editor of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, from the Confluence team, best wishes for Merry Christmas and a peaceful new year filled with good news.